I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 166 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser, and Andrew Frankel. Now occasionally we do kind of magazine style episodes where we cover a few different topics. That's what this week's episode is. We start off by discussing balance of performance and whether or not it's a good thing in racing, because I'm kind of in two minds about it, particularly after the other week's 24 Hours of Le Mans, which was very much influenced by balance of performance. But we also talk about road cars like the BMW i8 in What Goes Up, which is where we look at what's going on in the market. And we're doing the i8 this week because you can now buy one. Certainly there's one example in the UK of the i8 listed for less than £30,000, which, that is a lot of car for 30 grand, although quite a lot of miles as well. We'll come to that. And there's a few other bits that we discuss this week. Before we get into it, though, I will remind you all to rate and review the podcast. And while you're doing it, whichever app you're using, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button. It means you never miss an episode and it helps us a great deal. So please do that and enjoy the episode. Now, what we don't need to do, Andrew, is really get into the nitty-gritty of what happened at Le Mans, because it's been done. And we're probably a week too late to do that, aren't we? But I'd like to have a conversation, a broader conversation about balance of performance, because it's been in the news recently, hasn't it? And I think both you and I have expressed frustrations with it in the past.
Definitely. I mean, it's there to ensure close racing.
Yeah.
It all depends how you approach it, because on the one hand, there is a very large bit of me which thinks you come up with a rule book and you give it to everybody, and the team that does best by building the best cars, having the best drivers, having the best strategy wins, and that's great. Mm. The problem with that is, as we know, is that quite often one team just does that job better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, congratulations to them. But then you get these periods of total dominance. Look at what Porsche were doing at Le Mans in the 1980s. They won the race seven times on the trot. Audi at the beginning of this century. And frankly, it's very boring. And ultimately, what it does is it kills the sport.
Yeah.
Because other manufacturers think, well, why should we go and fight these guys when they appear to be insuperable? And spectators and fans walk away. Mm. So ultimately, it becomes, the way we would all, in theory at least, like to do it, becomes self-defeating. And so balance of performance is designed to address that. And basically, it is success penalties. And I hate the idea.
Mm.
But the reality is, and I don't think we're going to go back into Le Mans too much, is that you can create a situation where you have unbelievably close racing. It's absolutely thrilling. And if that means a team feel slightly aggrieved because they feel they've done the better job and they feel that they have been treated unfairly for doing that better job because they've received a penalty, then maybe that's a price worth paying if the result is a 24-hour race like the one we just had, where the outcome was really, really absolutely unknown for at least 22 of those hours. And everybody has a fantastic time. And it's only tedious, boring old farts like me who go, put their finger in the air and go, actually, that wasn't very fair.
Ah, interesting. Yeah, there are two very clear sides to this argument, and I can see both of them. I can see both of them. Because, as you say, just look at Le Mans. Balance of performance, that was the mechanism, that was the reason, really, that after 22 hours, you couldn't say who was going to win the race.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, in that regard, it was exciting. And actually, it gave us a different winner. It gave us Ferrari and a great story. But I watch it, and I do not know quite what I'm watching, okay? When I watch a motor race, I want great racing, of course. But I also feel like I need to know that I come away from watching it with an understanding of who did the best job, who has built the best car, which is the slickest team, who has the fastest, most consistent drivers.
Yeah. It's that thing about, you know, let the best man win. Yeah. Well, that's what BOP stops. You know, there's a good argument. I'm not saying it's a decisive argument, but there's a good argument which says that the best team didn't win Le Mans this year.
And you
can go into all the figures and everything else, but basically Toyota was given it's about a 0.4 of a second disadvantage per lap over Ferrari. Because of the difference. They both got weight added, but Toyota got 37 kilos, Ferrari just 24. And if you extrapolate that over a 24-hour race, that adds up to more seconds than the difference between the Toyota and the Ferrari at the end of the race. Now, it is nothing like as simple as that. And if the Toyota driver hadn't crashed 2 hours before the end and put the result beyond doubt, then, you know, it would have been a far closer finish. Toyota may well have won it. And you could say, well, then he shouldn't have crashed and that's his fault. But why did he crash?
Yeah.
He crashed because he was trying as hard as he possibly could. While in a car, which Toyota certainly thought had been unfairly disadvantaged. So, you can slice it up any way you like. To me, I think balance of performance is a necessary evil. I think you have to have it. Where it becomes massively problematic for me is where the people who set the rules, in this case, the ACO and the FIA, say, right, these are the rules. This is the balance of performance, and this is how it's going to be applied. And what they said at the start of this year was that they were going to set the balance of performance, and they would not change it until, this is the critical word, after Le Mans.
Yeah, they said that. They did say that.
Everybody signed up to that. And they said the only change they might make is between the LMH and the LMDH categories to even them up a bit. Well, Toyota and Ferrari were both in the same category, so that's an irrelevance. And then just before the test day, which was itself only a couple of days before Le Mans, they went back on it. And they handed... It's simply the truth. Because both Toyota and Ferrari got more weight, but Toyota got more weight than Ferrari. So they decided, completely contrary to what they had already committed to give Ferrari an advantage over Toyota. Why? Well, you could say that Toyota had won every race of the season so far, which it had, and therefore, you know, they needed to even things up a bit. A cynic would say that they would not have been blind to the fact that Ferrari winning the Centenary Le Mans on the 50th anniversary of its most recent participation there is a story that you just cannot not tell. It's just too good to not be able to tell it. And so they cynically disadvantaged Toyota and advantage Ferrari, so to give Ferrari a better chance of winning Le Mans. That is what the cynics would say. The truth, who knows? Who knows? I do not think... Okay, the only thing I don't agree with is the suggestion that Ferrari somehow... And we have seen this, and I'm not going to name names, but I have no doubt that a few seasons ago, a team compromised its performance in the early part of the season to get itself a good BOP benefit, yeah, because it won anything else, it wanted to win them all. I believe I have seen that. No one will ever admit it, but I believe I've seen it. I do not believe Ferrari did that this season. I think Ferrari came out with a brand new car, which, like all brand new cars, took a lot of bedding in, and they got quicker and quicker through the first three races of the season, so that by the end of it, they were really, really close to Toyota. I think they came out with the best car they could, and they developed as hard as possible. I do not have any truck with Ferrari at all.
No.
But all I would say, it boils down to this. Tell them what the rules are going to be and then stick to them. Don't change them at the last minute because it suits your agenda.
I agree with that. And the problem for me is that it leaves a great big question mark hanging over it. And BOP does leave itself open to manipulation, either by the regulators or by teams, as you've just suggested. Now, we should distinguish a little bit, because in the road car-based categories, maybe BOP is more palatable, because it does mean that a big, heavy front-engine GT car can race on a level playing field with a purpose-built mid-engine supercar. You know, I'm thinking,
yeah, exactly,
an Aston Martin versus a Ford GT, for instance.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's
absolutely,
that's great.
Yeah.
But
and actually, that's the reason that all the manufacturers pile in, because, yeah, you know, what they want to do is get their product in front of the spectators and the viewing public. And, you know, if you were Aston Martin, you know, with a road car, which you've turned into a racing car, against a Ford GT, which was built as a racing car, and from which road legal versions were derived, you know, you'd have no chance at all.
Mm.
So, yeah, you know, that is absolutely worthwhile.
But it's different in prototype categories. Now, let's just think a little bit about series that don't have balanced performance. And because there's a cautionary tale in that, and it makes us sort of understand what the consequences of not having any kind of levelling mechanism might be. So we're recording this the day after the Canadian Formula One Grand Prix. Max Verstappen won by 10 seconds at a circuit that they suspected wasn't going to suit their car.
Yeah.
And even so, I suspect if he wanted to, he could have won that race by 15, maybe 20 seconds.
Of course.
So
of course.
That Red Bull, particularly with Max driving, is dominant. It's won every race so far this year, the Red Bull. Max has won 6 of the 8. And actually, the race at the front of Formula One this year has not been very good, has it? It's not been at all exciting to watch.
That's what you get.
And that's what you potentially get. Clearly, the best scenario in racing is to have at least two teams on a very level playing field anyway, without any kind of BOP mechanism. And when it's like that, racing is unlike anything else. It's so spectacular to watch. 2021 Formula One. The trouble is, it's so rare, isn't it? It seems so rare that you have two teams on a level footing. And the status quo for a category with no BOP is that one team seems to dominate.
Let me ask you.
Go on.
If I think I understand you correctly, and this is certainly my view, that the problem with BOP is not the BOP itself, but its implementation.
Mm. Mm.
That BOP is, when done correctly, is a force for good. Would you introduce BOP into Formula One? And if not, why not? If we think that it's in theory at least, on paper at least, it's a good thing to have at Le Mans, why not in Formula One?
Okay, so for me there is a transparency issue. It is open to manipulation, as we know, and politics, you know, and why do the ACO make the decisions that they make? They don't tell us. We can't look at a spreadsheet and understand where that's come from. So I think that's a good reason for not introducing it in other categories. But even so, even though I understand why it's necessary, I still find it a little bit unpalatable, because I don't know what I'm watching. I don't know who the best driver is, who has built the fastest car. Maybe that doesn't matter if the racing is fantastic.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's transparency. And I think, you know, what I would do, and some people call this absolute heresy, is that I would introduce balance of performance into Formula One, because I think that net it is good for the sport. But I would be exactly what you said. I would be totally transparent about it.
Yeah.
And I would declare the rules, and every team would sign up to it, and they would know. I don't know how you would calibrate it, but, you know, and there would be ways around it. You couldn't do it, say, you know, if you win a race by 10 seconds, then you get, you know, 10 kilos on the next one, because they just make sure they didn't win a race by 10 seconds. But there would be ways of determining one speed, car speed relative to the other, and which could be applied across the board. And, you know, you would end up with a far, far... I mean, you know, I think there is a chance, isn't there, still, that... You know, Red Bull will do what has not been done by any team since the first season of Formula One in 1950 and win every single race.
Yes, it looks very possible.
I mean, you know, if it weren't for the fact that Perez appears to, you know, have completely given up, you know, if he was the proper number two and being Max's wingman, and it was so Max always had a Perez buffer. I mean, when he doesn't have that, you know, when Max is the only driver who can win a race in the Red Bull, then clearly, you know, Max can make mistakes, cars can break down, and it only needs that to happen once, and that possibility has gone. But I still think it's, I don't think it's likely, but I think it still could happen. I think it's as literally as likely to happen now as in 1988 when there were 16 races in the McLaren MP4 for one. 15 of them with Prost and Senna, the world's greatest motor racing double act. And I think, oh, I don't know. And, you know, BOP would ensure that didn't happen.
I do agree with that. I suppose my problem with BOP is that it's a blunt instrument. And as we say, there's no transparency. So there must be a subtler, more nuanced, more transparent way of doing it. And that would be what I would favour. I'm not bright enough to come up with that mechanism, but there are people out there who could. And so something that is transparent and clear and open and honest, but does effectively level the playing field, I'd be for that. I would be for that.
Even if you did, you know, I mean, and they do this in touring cars, don't they? They have reverse grids and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, ultimately, what are you watching? Are you watching a business, and that business happens to be motor racing? Are you watching a sport or are you watching a show? If your view is that it's all about entertainment, therefore that it's a show, you need to do all this stuff. If it's a sport, you don't have BOP, you just let everybody get on with it. And if it's a business, then I guess you have BOP and then you manipulate it the way you want it to be manipulated and don't tell anybody what you're doing or why you're doing it.
Yeah, and actually, Formula One might find itself in a bit of a pickle soon, because it's leaning towards show, isn't it? More recently, it's been leaning towards show, with, you know, sprint races and all the stuff that's going on around Formula One Grand Prix these days. And the audiences, as we know, are enormous. But the racing's not been great. And so I do wonder if it finds itself looking at... Okay, so no, let me clarify. The racing at the very front of the pack has not been great. And so maybe they're going to think, do you know what, we're going to lose this audience if we don't spice it up a little bit. It'd be interesting to see.
But at the same time, you know, there is nothing new under the sun. I go back to the original 1950 season when Alfa Romeo won every single race. Can you imagine how boring that was?
Formula One survived that, though, didn't it?
It survived that, and lots of periods. You know, remember the start of this century when, you know, Ferrari and Michael Schumacher, you know, I can remember thinking to myself, a really bad day at the office of Michael is when he comes second. It's a really bad day. And that's where we are with Max now.
Yeah, it is.
You know, if Max doesn't win a race, you know, every other driver on the grid would be delighted to come second, apart from Max, who'd be, you know, appalled. So, yeah.
Maybe as F1 fans, we just have to view it, the time that we put in, as an investment. You know, you'll have 3 or 4 years that aren't particularly exciting, but the payback is one fantastic one that we discuss for years and years. Maybe that's the way it works. Okay, let's leave BOP and motor racing there for now, because I want to do what goes up. And I think this one's going to get you quite worked up, Andrew, because just a couple of weeks ago, I spotted for the very first time a BMW i8 listed for less than £30,000.
That's a cheap car. Less than the price of a new electric Vauxhall Corsa.
That's your go-to, isn't it? The 31 it grand is. Vauxhall Corsa electric one, yeah.
That's the base Vauxhall Corsa.
Yeah, an i8.
What would you pay for an equivalent 911? 50?
So a sort of 9-year-old 911, 991. Yeah, probably maybe high 40s or something, but I would guess about that. So The i8 has come down. It's come down a long, long way. Now, this is a high-mileage car. There's only one of them. It's a high-mileage car. It's done 103,000 miles.
Ooh, that is a lot.
Which is pretty good, isn't it? But before we get into the numbers, let's just talk about why we like them. Because, you know, on paper, it's a plug-in hybrid. It's got this little three-cylinder turbo petrol engine. It's from a Mini, isn't it?
It is.
You'd think that a 911 with its flat six out back would just be automatically the more appealing car. And maybe it ultimately is. But we like an i8 nonetheless, don't we? It looks fantastic. Still looks good on the road when you see them. It has that.
I think they are fabulous cars.
Go on, why?
Okay, why? I'm so much more interested in the way that cars drive than the way they look.
Yeah.
And yet, when there was one parked outside here for a while, I couldn't walk past it without gawping at it. Even today, when you see one in the street or on the motorway or whatever, I think it's just a fabulous-looking car. It's such a clever car, and it's such an advanced car. I remember comparing it to an NSX, which was, you know, the second-generation NSX, and realising, you know, the i8 had a carbon tub. It could run on electricity only. You could plug it in. You can't do any of those things on an NSX. And it was just so easy to live with. I think people made the mistake of thinking that it was a sports car. It's not. It's a traditional GT. Mm. I love the driving position. I love its sort of languid manners. I love the fact that I could get in and out of the house without disturbing the neighbours. And because it was light... Because it was light, because it only had that little 1.53 cylinder engine, which did sound terrific. And I know people go, oh, yes, it was synthesised and it's not a real sound. Mm. But every single sound you hear from any modern car is synthesised. You know, just take my word for that, to some extent. It sounded great. It was more than quick enough. It was like sort of 4.5 seconds to 60.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, it's not a track car, but for undulating roads, I thought it handled really, really well. It had, you know, the sort of vestigial rear seats that you get in 911s and that sort of thing, so you could stick your shopping or to pinch your kid in the back. I just loved being in it. I had one for a while, and I did thousands and thousands of miles in it. And apart from, okay, I didn't like the attention it got, because you would just get
idiots.
But
particularly when it was brand new, it was it was an it car, wasn't it? It had wow factor.
I got out of that and into a 911, and I became instantly anonymous. Mm. I loved it. I didn't like the fact that you could never... You always, if you're going in a long-term car park or a supermarket or a multi-story, you always had to find a space at the end. Because if anybody came and parked too close, you literally couldn't get into the car. I didn't like that. The boot was small. Other than that, and the other thing was that, as someone who pays for their own fuel, you know, it would do 40-plus miles to the gallon everywhere. Mm. It was such a clever car. It was also, you know, the other thing that BMW did with the i8, I think because it was so innovative and so advanced and so out there at the time, the last thing they wanted were little things going wrong with it, because then it would get a reputation and that would kill the car. So they built it beautifully. I bet, I don't know, but that car you mentioned had done over 100,000 miles, I bet the owner has had bugger all problems with it. And that, to me, actually, from a second-hand point of view, is as good a reason as any to get into one, because I think, and please don't come back and tell me it's gone horribly wrong when you go and buy one, but my guess is that they are extremely robust, and, you know, a really, really great second-hand call. Now, I think they're getting a bit old now, so, you know, the tech won't be quite, you know, what it is these days, and, you know, and if you're into all your apps and your connectivity and everything else, then, you know, maybe it's not for you. But for a certain sort of person who just wants a car that which works so well in the real world, which looks that great, sounds that great, is that good to drive, £30,000, blimey. I mean, I've often thought about what I would get just to bimble about in when this business has had enough of me. And up there with a Cayman and a 911, the i8 has always been up there. Mm. And there are certainly fewer than five cars on that list, and an i8 is one of them.
I did when the i8 was brand new, I did a couple of group tests, including one for Evo magazine with, you know, the more conventional rivals, R8s, 911s, AMG GT, that sort of thing. And I, you know, never won those tests. And in some ways, it kind of felt a bit like the whipping boy, because it didn't have the raw power of some of the others.
It's not what it's about.
No, it's not what it's about at all. But I remember driving them on some fantastic roads. And actually really loving the fact that it didn't have the grip of those other cars, because it doesn't, you know, relatively skinny tires. No. And so unlike any of the others, it would sort of skate across the road a little bit without you being completely mad. And that, as much as anything, made them so enjoyable to drive. So I totally get the i8 thing. And I actually, like you, I just like being in them, because they've got that amazing sort of architectural cabin. I like that you can put it in electric only mode and zip through town. I just think they're fantastic. So I did do a little bit of research on how much trouble an almost decade old i8 is going to be. And, you know, whenever you get onto a forum for a specific car, you find issues, don't you? Because every car has them.
Well, because that's why people are on the forum.
That's why people are on the forum, yeah. So people tend to gather there, don't they? And problems become exacerbated. But actually, you know, it's not, as far as I can tell, it's not like there's one thing that totally undermines these cars. One bloke did say that his Petrol motor blew up. And he said, it didn't cost much to fix, only about €10,000. But that seems to be an isolated incident. Now, I don't know.
But that Petrol motor, it's a 228 horsepower, 1.5 three-cylinder engine out of a Mini. It should be indestructible.
Yeah. So hopefully that is isolated. Now, I don't know.
But also, you don't know whether, I don't know, somebody forgot to put any oil in it at the last service.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that could happen for any number of reasons, which has got nothing to do with the way BMW designed the car. Yeah.
Now, I don't know if the batteries could be problematic now that they're almost 10 years old. I've not read anything about that. I suppose it's not impossible.
No, but you know, when a car gets a problem, you know, like, you know, the engine in the 996 911 became known to be, you know, or the V10 that BMW built. When you have an engine that has a problem, you know, it doesn't take long for people to know and for reputations to that, and people, you know, talk about it, and it just becomes a known facet of that car's character. You've never got anything like that with the i8.
No.
It's not known for anything going wrong with it.
No, it's not.
I mean, like all cars, you know, nobody's ever designed the perfect indestructible car which will never, ever fail. No. But it seems to me that, you know, the i8 is, you know, is pretty impeccable compared to, you know, a lot of other things.
Now, so if you don't want a 103,000-mile i8, you can get a lower mileage one for about £34,000. So, you know, with about 80,000 miles or fewer.
So what would you pay for like a 40,000 miler? A really, I don't want a Roadster either.
No, I don't want a Roadster. I don't know off the top of my head, but I would guess that high 30s, maybe 40 grand would get you a good, tidy, not leggy car, I guess. Oh. So, you know, it's not like that 30 grand one is a total outlier. But let me complicate this for you.
Go on.
Audi R8 V8 manual, 2007, 57,000 miles, £32,000.
Well, we said before on this podcast that's nuts, haven't we?
I thought they'd be worth so much more by now. I thought they'd have rocketed.
They will one day. It will happen.
Mm.
It has to happen. you're dealing with a sort of slightly different era car.
Yeah. They're older.
They are older. I don't understand that. Okay, here's the question. What would you rather have? I would rather drive the Audi but live with the BMW.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Sadly, you can't unless you're spending 60 grand to get both. But I honestly find it quite tricky to separate those two, which actually reflects really well on the BMW, doesn't it? Because that Audi is a special, special car.
And I think what it also says is that, you know, I think anybody listening to this knows what we think of Porsche 911s. You know, they're pretty much the greatest cars in the world, but they're not the only cars that do that.
Mm.
And if you don't, and if you want something which is a bit more, you know, imaginative, different, you know, an i8 or an R8 is a fabulous alternative.
So I did ask JBR Capital to look into this, and one of the interesting bits of data they got for me was that the average age of a customer of an R8 is 37. God. Actually, that's surprising. I'm 36, and I'm not a year away from buying an R8. Goodness me. And the average age of an i8 customer is 41. So maybe there is
Even that's younger than I thought. I thought the average age of an i8 customer would be like not far short of 50. Mm. I think it's a middle-aged man's car. Probably why I like it so much.
But I kind of agree. And it does make sense, doesn't it, that the average age of an i8 customer is higher. Not much, but a bit higher. Either way, you know, however you're spending that kind of money, two fantastic options there. They really are very, very special cars. What Goes Up is sponsored this week by car finance specialist JBR Capital. We've been working with JBR Capital for a while now, and it's been a brilliant partnership for us. High-end car finance is all the company does, meaning it understands the car market and car buyers better than most. So before you buy your next sports car, supercar, classic car, luxury car, even a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Visit jbrcapital.com or click the link in description. And this bit is important. Tell them the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Now, let me just talk about another car that I went to go and look at last week. It's called the Nyobolt EV. It's kind of like a Restomod Series 1 Lotus Elise. And we took a real interest in it because our contributor, Julian Thompson, designed the Series 1 Elise. And he's redesigned it now for this electric reimagining of the Series 1 Elise. It looks fantastic in person. It's very clearly inspired by the Series 1, but just with more muscle, with modern detailing, more dramatic, more supercar-like proportions, basically. So I thought it looked really cool, and the technology is interesting. It is an EV. It's based on a late model Lotus Exige. So they say that it would weigh under 1,500 kilograms, maybe under 1,300 kilograms, they're being a little bit coy about it. But it's got this clever battery. And actually, in many ways, it's the battery that's more interesting because it's quite small. It's a 35 kilowatt hour thing.
That's which very is small. Diddy. It's like a mini E battery.
Yeah, it's diddy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a single electric motor with 470 horsepower. So it would feel potent. There's no question about that. But the clever thing about this Nyobolt battery is that it's a really innovative thing. So it's still lithium ion, and for many, many years, all the research and development on lithium ion batteries has basically revolved around the cathode. They've turned their attention to the other part, the anode, which is actually what determines how quickly you can charge a battery.
You've already lost me.
But the upshot is that on a very fast charger, 350 kilowatts, so that is a rapid charger. There aren't too many of those around. You can go from literally 0% to 100% in 6 minutes.
Wow. So why isn't everybody doing this? If it was as simple as just switching from one end of the battery to the other.
Well, it's a proprietary technology, and I'm sure it's heavily protected. So Nyobolt will hope that everybody will be doing it soon and making them very wealthy. And that's all wonderful. And actually, you know, 0 to 106 minutes is something, but you never run it down to 0, do you? So at worst, you're going from 5 and you might only run it up to 80. So what, you're going to do that in 3.5, 4 minutes if you have the right kind of charger?
It's always the last 10% which takes longest to go in. So yes, I mean, they usually sort of quote a sort of 20 to 80 time. Mm. That's the sort of standard charge cycle that people talk about. you know, you could probably hold your breath in the toilet. I mean, certainly by the time you've gone inside,
yes,
you know, had a pee, come out again, your car's charged.
Yeah. It's like filling up with petrol, isn't it? Except you don't have to hold the lever. Now, the interesting thing about this is it sort of opens up a new world of EV driving. And wouldn't it be better if we had a fantastic charge network?
very light EVs.
And there you go, and EVs with much, much, much smaller batteries.
Yeah.
And this technology, which means they can be charged very quickly. And it would make electric cars much lighter, significantly lighter, more fun to drive, particularly electric sports cars. We know they're coming. They would use far fewer precious earth metals because the batteries are smaller. That's a better way, isn't it? Rather than having a enormous 120 kilowatt hour battery that takes so long to charge.
It is a better way. I mean, you'd still have to stop more often, even if you weren't stopping for very long.
Yeah.
It's like you're sort of in and out in the pit stop. People say it's only done 2.4 seconds pit stop, but actually the pit stop still takes 20 seconds. You've still got to come down the pit lane and go out the other end. And that, you know, you still have to do that regardless how big your battery is. Mm. And so, you know, I don't particularly enjoy service stations. I don't particularly enjoy stopping. I just like, that's why I used to love diesel cars, because you go, you know, you could drive from here to Geneva without stopping. So you still have to sort. So I don't think it's the sort of ultimate solution to everything, but it's got to be better. You're absolutely right. Than particularly with sporting cars, with really heavy cars with these really profligate, massive batteries. They're, you know, batteries that weigh as much as an entire car. Mm. You know, I don't know exactly, but you know, a 110 kilowatt hour battery probably weighs about the same as a Caterham.
Yeah, the 120 kilowatt hour battery in a Rimac weighs 600 kilos.
There you go. Yeah, which is more than a Caterham. Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It's got to be the way forward. So the question is, are they going to make it?
They're going to make one. They are going to build a proper development mule, which is going to start running in November. I hope it would be great to have a go, wouldn't it? They don't know. They don't know if they're going to build a few for customers. And it'll always be low volume if it does go into production. I think the trouble is that once you've put that battery and everything else in it, it becomes extremely expensive. And it's sort of at odds with the whole point of a Lotus Elise, isn't it? To have a very expensive sports car.
But it's not really a Lotus Elise anymore. It looks like that, but it's a sort of technology. And also, I think that, you know, having, you know, Julian involved, both, I guess, in the original car's design and this car's design, is quite something. I guess, I presume they're just waiting to see whether the demand's out there, whether enough people bang on their door and go, got to have one of these.
No one who's built, and they're very different cars. They have 2,000 horsepower and seven-figure price tags. No one who's built one of those has yet put out a press release saying, hurrah, they're all sold.
It's interesting, isn't it?
And they've been around a little while now. They've been at a lot of shows. They've been on a lot of telly shows, in lots of magazines. And actually, you know, there is speculation out there that the likes of the Rimac Nevera, Lotus Evija, the Pininfarina Battista, that they're not selling. And perhaps that weighs on the minds of anyone wondering if they should put a car of that kind, even if it costs much, much less, into production. So,
but if it was me and I had the choice of, and I don't, I'm going to make numbers up. Something like a Pininfarina Battista is a seven-figure car. Mm. But let us say, you know, I'm a wealthy bloke. Would I rather have a car that was designed by Julian, that was light and fun,
innovative,
and still fast and innovative for half the price, a third of the price? Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Because they're both toys. Mm. You know, you're never going to go, use one as your daily driver. So ultimately, these are just automotive recreations. And I really like the way the car looks. I really like its history. I like the technology. So if I were in the market for a car like that, and I absolutely am not for more than one reason, I'd just be more interested in Julian's car.
Okay, would you be more interested in the Porsche Mission X?
Possibly.
Have you?
Yeah.
Did you have a look at this? It was announced during
yeah,
the
I mean,
month,
I've been I've been doing that rarest of rare things for a freelancer. I've been on holiday for a fortnight, so I'm not as close to it as. But we should talk about it.
So this is Porsche. They released this Mission X concept, and apparently the decision as to whether or not it'd be put into production is yet to be taken. But
we know about Porsche concepts, though, don't we? We've seen this so often before.
They're going to build it. We think they're going to build it, and it's a successor to the 918 Spider. So it's in that 959 Carrera GT 918 bloodline, you know, top rung Porsche hypercars. And it's all electric. And all they've said so far is that it will have a 1-to-1 horsepower to kilogram ratio. And some have speculated that that's around 1500 of each. I think it'll be more. I think it's probably 1700 of each. And if it does go into production, they say it's essential that it's the fastest road legal car on the Nürburgring Nordschleife. Ugh, as if that matters.
Not just fastest EV, fastest
road legal car. Yeah, so fastest
it's got to do a sub 6.5 minute.
Yeah, lap. Yeah, yeah. So rapid. What to say about this? Okay, what I will say is that it's very interesting that Porsche is as committed to synthetic fuels, more so than any other car maker, and yet is still pursuing this all-electric powertrain hypercar thing. It shows that they're broad-minded, at least. And perhaps Porsche has enough cachet to overcome the skepticism around very high-performance EVs that appears to be out there at the moment, which seems to be why the existing players in that market are not selling fast enough. So perhaps the Porsche would sell, but they'd be a little bit hesitant, wouldn't they, given what's going on in the market?
You just never know with those guys, do you? I mean, what they're so good at is just sitting back and watching everybody else make the mistakes first.
And then going, okay, so
and
don't
learning,
do that.
Learning, and, they, and then go, okay, so this is how we're going to do it. Don't know. Interesting.
Did you like the way it looked?
Quite.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, that's the right word, isn't it? Quite.
Yeah, I wasn't knocked out by it. Not the way that I was knocked out by the Carrera GT. And indeed the 918. But, you know, it probably won't look exactly like that when it comes out.
No. And I do wonder if it's supposed to preview a new Porsche, and I know you hate this expression, design language. If it does, I hope they sort of refine it a little bit, because I wasn't blown away. Perhaps it's one of those cars that when you see it in person and you get a better sense of the proportions and the stance, it looks better. But I have to say, I don't love it. Let's do the listener question then. Should we do some Newey first?
Yeah, I think we should just do some Newey first. Yeah, I do. I think it's just were you going to do that after the listener question?
No, we'll do some Newey first, because actually I'd like to talk about him. And just to tee it up, I will just point out that the Formula One Canadian Grand Prix podium was just fantastic. Max on top.
Yeah.
Fernando Alonso next to him. Lewis Hamilton next to him. And Adrian Newey up there representing Red Bull as the winners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Goodness me. That's the cream of the crop, isn't it? They are the three best drivers in F1. I think there's no question for me. With the standout designer. It was fantastic to see. And I did take a screenshot of this actually. Someone counted all their Grand Prix wins, and it was 376 between them.
Wow, that's ridiculous. No, it can't be.
Well, Newey's got 200.
Newey. Oh yeah, well, you put Newey.
Lewis has got 103. Max 41. Fernando 32. But I just thought it was so cool to see those four guys up there as the very best of the bunch. So it was Newey's 200th victory as a Formula One designer.
Yeah. Now, put that into context. If Adrian Newey were a Formula One constructor, a company in his own right, that one man would be the second most successful Formula One constructor of all time.
Second most?
Second most. Ferrari have won more races. I think they've won about 240. Mm. Nobody else has got close to 200.
Just Newey.
Just knew he. And he's done it over a period of just over 30 years, when Ferrari have done it in a period of, well, I mean, however long Formula One has been going, 73 years. So his achievements in his field are absolutely unparalleled. You know, he has, you know, one person has won designs that have won races across a 30-year period. He also went to forget, he also won two titles in IndyCar, in CART in the US. And if you haven't read his book, How to Build a Car, which came out in 2017, just go and get it. It is such, I mean, it's kind of a biography, and it is a biography, it's an autobiography. It, it talks an awful lot about his life and that sort of thing. But it's all seen through the prism of the various things that he designed, how he designed them, and what it was about them which gave them the edge that they so often had over everybody else. And you think of the people that he has designed, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? To me, it is absolutely amazing that, you know, this year, without any doubt at all, Max Verstappen will win the world title in a car designed by Adrian Newey. The first person to win a world title in a car designed by Adrian Newey, Nigel Mansell.
Oh, he could be Max's dad. You know,
the second one was Alain Prost. You know, Alain Prost was, you know, was racing cars in the, was he in Formula One in the 1970s? I mean, it's just the eras he has spanned.
And how the technology has evolved and he's kept up with it.
Exactly. Totally. And all the eras that he's gone through, you know, all, remember all the active era and all that sort of stuff that's sort of come and gone. And whether they've been, you know, Atmo cars or turbo cars or hybrid cars or whatever, he has always just managed to. And we can't, you know, well, obviously, you know, now as a whatever he is, he's a director of engineering or whatever, you know, it's not just him. He has a team of hundreds and hundreds of people. But ultimately, he has ultimately. Yeah, but I think what happens is with these people now is the team go off and they say, this is what we think we should do. And then he looks at it and he goes, yes or no. I don't think he is necessarily sitting there designing the car. Maybe he does sketch out the, I mean, I do remember when I went to see him recently, there was still a drawing board in his office, which I was amazed to see.
I think famously he still uses it,
He still uses it. And, you know, Adrian must be 64, 65 now. But he appears to have lost none of his. In fact, you know, you could say that, you know, certainly the car from last year and this year. I mean, the dominance has just been absolutely unbelievable. He's lost none of his edge, and yeah, I just thought that on the occasion of his 200th win, we ought to shout it out and go, you know, congratulations. He's also. I don't know him at all well, but I've met him a few times. He's one of those guys that if you show a level of a bit of enthusiasm and a bit of knowledge, then he'll just suddenly engage with you. And when I went to interview him last year, I think it was last year. Yeah, I think back into last year, I sat down with him and we had a like a sort of 20-minute, maybe half an hour slot. And he did say, I really do have to be done at the end of that. And an hour and a half later, we were still talking. And, you know, I asked him about the Senna accident and all that sort of thing. And he was incredibly honest about that. And, yeah, I just really like the guy. I just really, really like the guy. So, yeah, congratulations, Adrian. Absolutely. An achievement as outstanding as any I can think of in the whole field of motor racing, frankly.
Absolutely right. Yeah, fantastic. And actually, your interview with him for the Last Blast podcast is on the TI app and website, if anyone wants to go and listen to it now. Totally agree. Totally agree. Outstanding achievement. Okay, so to wrap this episode up, we're just going to do a listener question. This one comes from Dewey. It's a good question.
Is that by good, you mean I'm going to find it impossible to answer?
Yeah, but through choice, you know, too much choice.
Okay.
And it's, we have to forget the sort of realities of it here. but the question is, if you could win any motor race in the world, what would it be and what car would it be in? And so the car also defines the era. So it doesn't matter how old you are when you were born. You can choose any era, any car, any race.
Oh, that's just easy.
Yeah, okay. No, it's going to be Le Mans in a Porsche 917, isn't it?
Correct, of course it is.
Okay, but what would come close for you to... Did you have a think about the Indy 500 or Monaco? Or?
No, absolutely not. No, none of the above. It would have been nice to... Well, I suppose... No, I mean, no.
Nothing
Sorry.
Comes close to
I
you,
mean,
does it?
Spa 1000 Ks in 1973 and a Ferrari 312 PB. Mm. That would have been good. Mm. Le Mans again in a Porsche 962. That would have been good. Or a Jaguar XJR. No, but no, I mean, there's only one answer to that question. Mm. And it's Le Mans in a 5-litre, 5-speed, short tail 917. There you go.
You can't see this, but Andrew's grinning broadly while he describes that. So I totally believe him. Okay, well, I think mine would be Rally Monte Carlo, and I would do it in...
It's not a race.
Yeah. I think actually his question said of any kind, so I'm counting it. I'm doing it in the late 90s in a two-door Impreza WRC. I'm 13 years old, so it's an even better achievement.
Yeah.
And...
I was six when I won Le Mans on my 917.
Goodness me. Congratulations. So, yeah, I think I'd choose the Monte. To have won the Monte during that era in that car, yeah, that's what I'd take. That's a fun question, Dewey, so thank you so much. please keep your questions coming across because they're good fun. They're a nice way to end the episode, and we'll do it again next week.
See ya. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.